You're listening to Authorpreneurs Unleashed with host Catherine McClatchy, demystifying the business of writing. If a picture is worth a thousand words, then a book cover is worth a novel. But how do you choose a design that conveys the right message to grab the eyes of potential readers and prepare them for the journey your book is written to take them on? Catherine called in graphic designer, author, and Authorpreneurs Unleashed listener Elaine Canyon to talk about the unique design situations that apply to cover design. Elaine also talks about her complex neurodivergency, the perks and the challenges it brings, along with her strategies to leverage them to become a powerful tool in her author toolbox.
Hello, Authorpreneurs. I am so excited to introduce you to my guest, Elaine Canyon, today. Elaine actually was a listener who then became a friend and now is a trusted collaborator. So I have asked her to talk about two seemingly disparate topics, but we're going to weave them together if you give us a chance. So Elaine is a graphic designer. She has a YouTube channel that she shares all things about discovery writing and cover design. She also has talked about some neurodivergent type things and some mental health things we've had conversations about. So we're going to kind of weave all those conversations together over the next 30 to 45 minutes. So Elaine, welcome to Authorpreneurs Unleashed.
Thank you. I'm excited. This is kind of fun to be on the podcast that I started listening to a long time ago.
I am so grateful. So again, this is the joy of doing the podcast. I get to meet really cool people and a lot of them have become friends. So I am really pumped about that. And then a lot of friends I get to bring on the podcast. So It's a win-win. So tell me about Elaine. And I know you're a writer. You just have is it ARC out or is the book actually launched yet?
So the ARCs are out and I got my first reader response back and I got 5 stars from that reviewer. So that was fun. But yeah, so Love Ships and Sea Serpents is the first book in the Outcasts of Nerland series. It is a fantasy romance series. It's closed door romance. And everything I write is romance stories, first and foremost, and then they are set in bright fantasy worlds, and they have a heavy dose of humor with them.
I saw something saying you wrote romanticy.
Yeah, romanticy is another word for it.
I hadn't heard that term before.
It's one of my favorite terms because it means romance stories in fantasy worlds. And so instead of having the story be specific to a fantasy, like hero's journey, you get to have all of the fun of a fantasy world, but your story is about two people falling in love and overcoming obstacles to be together. And I love that.
That is brilliant. I saw that term and I'm like, okay, how did I go this long and not know that? So I am trying my hand at fantasy. I don't write romance, but then again, there might be a little touch of that in there too, because, you know, Amanda Arista taught me about romantic subplots. So we are working that direction.
That's awesome.
Okay. So what we really want to get into is the idea of cover art. And this came to the forefront as we were talking, because I wanted to show you a potential client I might be working with had done her own cover art. And when she showed it to me, it screamed a completely different genre than what she said her book was. It seemed off on a number of levels. And so I showed it to you and I said, tell me what you think. And you started breaking it down. And so I really want to dive into this because I know we have a lot of indie authors who are DIYing as much as they can for budgetary reasons or because they think they know what they're doing. And just like marketing, cover design changes and has trends and has what's popular now. So part of the problem with that cover is it looked like it came out of the 70s, in my opinion. I lived in the 70s. I remember what that looked like. So talk to us about maybe some of the mistakes you see individuals making and how we can do better.
So one of the main mistakes I see is indie authors that just don't understand the basics of design. One of the things that when I started my YouTube channel that was really important to me was teaching the basics. Because if you understand the basics, then it creates a much easier time for you as you go through and you create your cover. And so being able to understand what different types of layout or composition is actually what we call it in design school. We call it composition, but the layout, where are you putting the title? Where are you putting your author name? What elements are you using and how are you drawing the eye in? And then typography, the same thing. What is the psychology that you are communicating with typography, with color? Because if I use a specific color for a genre, I can very quickly take a good cover and make it a bad cover by just changing the colors. And it can still look good. It can still be good color theory. It can still be good color theory where the colors match and they work well together. But by just simply changing the colors, I can take a book that was communicating its genre well, and now it's not because I've switched the colors and the colors still look appropriate.
Right. And I think that was one of the problems. It was lots of pastels and lots of soft watercolor feels. And it was a beautiful cover, but it wasn't on point for the genre. Mm-hmm. I think that's the thing we forget is that from where I'm sitting, the cover is the first and most essential piece of marketing for your book. And if you mess up the cover, it really is hard to sell what's inside the book.
Exactly. It's one of those things where authors, I like to tell authors when I get to work with them directly, that your art and your expression stops when you write the end. Everything after that is marketing. Everything after that is being able to communicate the feeling and the experience of the art you've created through an image. And book covers, readers recognize it. You can talk to anyone who reads consistently. And if you ask them, well, what do you look for when you're scrolling through Amazon or Google or Kobo, whatever their reader is, and they'll be able to tell you. Romance readers can tell you very, very specifically. Someone in my family will tell you that she looks for cowboys on the fronts of her covers because she reads Western romances and she reads cowboy romances. And so she will skim right past your book if it doesn't have a cowboy on the front, because that's not what she's reading.
Or the opposite is true. A lot of them, you know, if you have, we're picking on the romance genre because I think everybody's familiar with it. But I worked with one client who all her covers were very steamy. Half-dressed people. Her website was covered with half-dressed people or less. And the thing was, her stories were so much more, had more than sex and going on, right? She talked about so many different things and it was really deep and very complex. And the way she was presenting those covers kind of belied how much was in it. You know what I'm saying? And consequently, some of her reviews were very off because the audience who bought that book was expecting a steamy bodice ripper. And what they got made them think and made them, you know, learn about things. And that wasn't what they were in for, right?
Exactly. It's so important to make sure that your cover is communicating an experience. It is the first bit of marketing that any potential reader sees. And because of that, you want it to be very on point. You want it to be incredibly obvious to the reader what they're going to get. So your cover should never tell the story. And most of the time, there are very few exceptions. Most of the time, your cover should not be a scene from your book. It really shouldn't.
Then that's what a lot of people are doing wrong.
It is. It is one of the things that I see a lot where someone says, oh, well, this is a scene from my book and I can use Photoshop and I can recreate it. That scene from your book isn't going to communicate the entire experience of your book. And for a lot of authors, that's hard because now they have to really dig deep and say, okay, what am I giving a person with this story? As opposed to what is my story about? And a lot of graphic designers and cover designers are really good at having you tell them what your story is about, and they can pull from that and they can create a cover off of that. But if you're doing it on your own, you have to be able to do that yourself. You have to be able to take a step back and look objectively at the book and say, what experience am I giving a reader when they read this?
So it's absolutely relationship marketing in that you are taking it from the reader's perspective, the person who's going to buy the book. You got to look at it through their eyes. It's not your baby anymore.
Exactly. And even for me, I designed my own covers. And even for me, I had to take a pretty big step back. Like it was harder than I thought it was going to be. And I've been a graphic designer for 8 years now. And I still had to take that really big step back. And my first few iterations, I looked at them and I went, oh, these are not good. Like I had to step back and say, yeah, I got really into this one thing and I need to let it go because this doesn't work.
Mm. Okay. I have another question. So we spend a lot of time on the marketing and author branding side, coming up with the visuals that represent your author brand, your colors, your fonts, your, you know, thematic logo kind of thing. And I'm seeing authors who think that they have to use those colors, those fonts, those images in their cover art. How do you feel about that? And is there a rule of thumb that we should know?
So it really depends. So as far as colors go, I would say absolutely not. Your colors should match your genre. Whatever your author branding colors are, those are going to be specific to your story, your marketing story that you're trying to tell. But when it comes to your cover, your colors, like I said at the beginning, I can take a romance cover and the only thing I change are the colors, and I can make you think that this might be a horror book by just changing the colors. So specific,
because that gets into all the color psychology.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It gets into color psychology. And so I can very much confuse you by shifting all of the colors in a cover and make it so the reader doesn't really know what they're getting into. Typography, I will say that if your author logo name is in a typeface that is very legible and somewhat plain, for lack of a better term, in that it can go with other types very well, other typefaces very well, then I would say you could, if you wanted to, use that as the typeface on your covers for just your author name. But if your author name is swirly, or if your typeface for your author name is got swirls or it's very serifed or anything like that, if it's not a really simple plain font, then you can run into a lot of problems when you're trying to make sure that your author name is appropriately communicated on your cover. And that changes based on where you are in your author career. So for example, Stephen King, his name gets to take up over half of his covers because he's Stephen King.
Because his name is what sells his books.
His name is what sells the book. Yeah. If you have 10 books out, then or less than 10 books or less than 20 books even, if you're not an author where your name is selling books, your author name should be pretty small and it should blend really well into the rest of the cover, because what's selling your cover is the marketing of your cover. It's not your name.
That is important to know, because I think a lot of authors that are DIYing it and a lot of brand new cover designers go out and they look at the best-selling books and they try to use that as inspiration and kind of mimic the proportions and so forth. But yeah, Stephen King can write on a toilet paper roll and it's going to sell, you know, because it says Stephen King. And I can think of half a dozen other authors I know. For my dad, if it said John Grisham on it, it didn't matter what the genre was. He was going to buy it, you know?
Exactly.
My brother travels a lot. Whatever's in the airport, he has, because he's racing, he just looks for an author that he's comfortable with. He wants to see that big. So that makes sense. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it's interesting to see. I can always spot if a cover is done by a graphic designer that's just entering the field, or if a cover has been done by an indie author that's trying to make their own cover for things like that. That's one of the number one giveaways, is a brand new author or an author that has less than 10 to 20 books out has their name taking up the bottom third of the cover. I'm like, oh, can I help you, please? Can we fix this, please?
Yeah. Yeah, that's, we definitely need help. Okay, so let's talk about the fads and fashions. How do you know to keep up on that, other than, you know, copying the best-selling books and the big, you know, traditional publishers that have in-house design? What are some rules of thumb or some tips or tricks that we can be looking for?
So one of the easiest ways to do it is you'll actually see a lot of authors suggest this when they talk about writing to market, that they'll tell you at least once a week or once a month, go on to all of the platforms that sell books and scroll through and look and see what is selling in the new releases right now. And so they go through and they check that. Mm. And that's how they start kind of gauging writing to market. I do the same thing, but I do it for what is coming out in covers. So what were the new releases this week? I read specifically, I like reading in the Google Play Books app. And so I'll open that up and I will click on new releases and I'll sort by the top 100 new releases and I'll look through and I'll see, okay, what's happening? What am I seeing coming out? What are designers trying? What are they not trying? If you are an indie author, it's really important to stay very genre specific. So don't do a Google search of this, because a Google search is going to take you into traditional publishing. And if you are a book designer in traditional publishing, you work very differently than a book designer in indie publishing. And
because they're planning 2 years ahead.
Well, they're planning 2 years ahead, and their book cover designers have a specific style that they have to follow. Because it has to look like it came from that publisher. And so I'm not quite as good at it as I probably could be if I really put the effort into it. But I'm getting to the point where I can say, oh, those all came from the same publishing house because they follow a very specific style.
Now that you mention it, so the obvious thing would be like Harlequin romances.
Exactly.
We all know that this cover is this type of Harlequin romance because there's a template they just plug and play kind of thing.
Exactly.
I also noticed I had another client I worked with who changed publishing houses. And boy, you can look on her website where she lists all the books and you know exactly when that change happened just by the covers.
Exactly. And so the nice thing about being an indie is you actually get to fall into a more focused set of covers, because indie cover designers will make sure, a good one, will make sure that your genre is communicated as succinctly as possible so that any reader who looks at the book is going to go, oh, I know exactly what genre that is. And they can probably even dig down a little deeper and give you subgenres based on your cover.
Wow. Yeah, when I worked with another graphic designer, when we redid my website, and she had done the original layout too, but we changed my colors because when we first set it up, I was writing mystery and I was more interested in my writing than building Unleashing the Next Chapter. And then years go by and that kind of flip-flopped. And not only was I not writing quite as much mystery, but I was writing a little more fantasy. And she's like, yeah, this is too dark. We got to lighten this up. So I that makes sense. Okay, so one of the things you and I were talking about the other day is how you have an innate ability to see patterns and colors and all of that.
So I land on the autism spectrum disorder range. And then I also have ADHD and I have OCD. And what that does is that it allows my brain to pick up on when design is working and when it's not, because there's a lot of points where even before I went to school, I could look at a design and I could say, I don't know what's wrong with that, but it's wrong. And I would change this, this, and this, and I think that would fix it. And then after I went to design school, I was able to say, oh, it is wrong because this color and this color do not create color harmony. And you need to switch to this color so it works. Or this font is getting the wrong color psychology. We need to switch it so that it's giving the correct psychology. And so what that does for me, and part of the reason I have the YouTube channel, is that I can look at a book cover and I can tell you really quickly if it's working or if it's not, why it's working and why it's not. And so I do this a lot for people. I'm in certain communities and I've got people that will come to me and say, hey, Elaine, this is the cover I'm working on. What do you think? And I can tell them very quickly, your colors are off, or your typography is off, or your composition is off. More times than not, I think for indie authors trying to design their own cover, composition and color, those are the two things that I see happen to be what they struggle with. Fonts, they get lucky with a lot of the time, and a lot of them can say, they can look at it and they can say, oh, well, I shrinked it down to a thumbnail and I couldn't read it, so I'm going to switch to something else. That is a good rule of thumb, by the way. Please, please always take your cover and shrink it down to very small, to the Amazon thumbnail
size. Postage stamp size, yeah. Right.
And make sure you can read it, because if you can't read it, it's wrong. But my mental health challenges allow me to really thrive in this field and be able to see things that other people don't immediately see and be helpful. I like being helpful. I like being able to tell an author, hey, you've got the right idea with your cover. Now, if you go back and shift this and this, it will be even better.
I love having this conversation because, as many of my listeners and followers know, invisible disabilities and challenges is definitely one of the things that I speak out a lot about. And I think in your case, we've been doing stuff for almost a year together, and it didn't click for me that you were on the spectrum. So, you know, a lot of times, and again, I say spectrum very carefully because it is a big range. You know, I feel like for quite a while, and TV and news is getting better about not showing the worst and letting us all assume that that's the worst, and that's all there is. But I know I have family members on the spectrum, and you wouldn't know because they've found career paths that really use those special skills, right? One of them calls himself neurospicy. And, but it's because of that, that he excels at what he does. Now, he can't always explain it in a way people can understand. Social skills might be a little bit of a struggle, but man, he can find those patterns, and he's very artistic, and he thinks outside the box. And I think there's a lot more in our author community that are on the spectrum than maybe even they realize.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those things that I like to remind people all the time. There are multiple people in my family and in my in-law family that are on the spectrum, and all of us handle it differently. And all of us show and express certain symptoms of autism differently. And I think that's an important thing to remember, especially when people write autistics. There's a very popular romantasy book that I didn't love it. And it's not because it wasn't representative of what a lot of autistic individuals go through, but I didn't love it because it was very much not what I go through. So the book, I don't want to call it out. But the book was about a young woman who could not feel emotion until she found her soulmate. And she had been cursed that way. So she could not feel emotion. And I could.
That's the fantasy part of the romance.
Yeah, that's the fantasy part of the romance.
Okay.
And
because falling in love does not change your brain patterns.
Exactly. It does not. My husband will tell you it does not change how you act. Because I did not change much after we got married. But it bothered me because as my experience with autism is I feel emotion like 10 times as strong as a lot of other people do. So I will watch a movie, and if I haven't gone through and read the entire detailed plot synopsis of what's happening in that film, I will become obsessive over it. And I will watch it 15, 16 times a day. Like, it will just play on repeat on headphones on my phone for weeks.
Now, is that the autism or the OCD, or is there crossover there? Because a lot of folks have multiple diagnoses. Yeah. So I just want to be real clear. Very rarely do you see somebody with a standalone diagnosis.
Right. So talking to my therapist about it, what we've talked about is that is the emotion that my autism feels that so strongly, that the movie was so much emotion and it pulled so much out of me, that in order to try and process it, the OCD comes in and I spin on it over and over and over again until my brain can completely process and expel the energy that emotion has brought into my life. And so I'm really careful about what I watch because it will derail me if I'm not careful. Mm-hmm. So I watch a lot of the same things over and over again, much to my poor husband's dismay. It drives him nuts. He's like, Didn't you watch this like 3 weeks ago? Yeah, I'm going to watch it again.
It's almost like the kids, you know, and I think that's part of, like you said, your brain grappling with it and processing things. But you see this in elementary school kids and maybe even preschool kids where they want the same story every night and they want to watch the same movies on repeat. And I think a lot of that is learning and figuring things out. But in your case, there's an emotional quotient to it. So that's really intriguing because I think the general public has been told that on the autism spectrum, you don't have the emotions or the ability to connect with other people. So that's why I think it's so important to talk about a lot of these things like migraine disorder. Again, it's a spectrum. Exactly. The way I experience migraine, not the same as other people's experiences. And as we're writing diverse characters, I want to make sure we give people enough inspiration and correct information to have diverse characters, not just as far as color and gender, but let's talk about illnesses and mental health and, you know, the fact that we're all, we have different learning styles and different communication styles and different love languages. I mean, there's just so much. You also made a comment when we were talking the other day that I'd love for you to address a little more the moral. Was that in regards to the OCD or the autism that it was morally motivated?
So my OCD, I have a type of OCD that is morally triggered. And so you can make most people can look back on their life and they can remember specific instances of like fun memories or traumatic memories. I am capable of remembering the very specific details of when I have made a mistake, specifically a mistake that makes me think that I would be a bad person. And so like I've hurt another person, I've said something mean to a sibling. I can go back and I can tell you who it was that I made the mistake with, exactly what I did, how I felt in that exact moment. My age, I can't tell you exact dates, but I can tell you how old I was. And I'm in my mid 30s now. And I have had to learn to the term that a therapist will tell you is grounding, but it's a way to bring yourself back to the present. And because if I don't do that, I will sit there and spin on what a terrible person I am for the thing I did at 8 years old, or the thing I did at 13 years old, or the thing I did at 19 years old, or the thing I did at 22 years old, or the thing I did yesterday. And it can be very overwhelming. For me specifically, one of the ways that helps me handle that is to focus on faith. And I'm a Christian, and so I'm able to focus on my belief in a Savior who has paid for my sins and who knows that I'm not perfect and is there to take that from me and give me a chance. So that helps me. I know for other people who struggle with it, grounding is how they work with it, and other tools and techniques, meditation, hypnosis, other things to help bring your mind back to the present. I still have other OCD tics. I have a stack of bowls that are different colors and they must be in the correct color order. And it's not rainbow ordered. It's like ordered by the colors that my children liked at that time. Yeah, it's very specific. And if they're out of that order and I notice, I will fix it. And it's a scenario of if I don't fix it, I will fight it. Like it overtakes my thoughts and I will sit there and I will think about that's wrong and I need to fix it and it needs to be fixed now. And if I walk away from it, that's all I will think about for the rest of the day until I go back and fix it. Cause it overtakes everything. It becomes the end all be all. It's the most important thing. And if I let it go, then the feeling is almost like letting a bus hit a car. It's really hard to describe, but it feels like the world is ending or like something terrible or tragic is happening. And so there's a lot of work of grounding and coming back to the present and saying, this is not okay. And then allowing little things to still be the thing I give into. So I don't allow myself to focus on what a terrible person I've been in the past, even though everyone tells me that when I do tell them what I'm focused on, they go, you're really being hard on yourself for that. You realize that, right? And no, I don't realize it. but keeping the bowls stacked in a certain order doesn't hurt anybody and it doesn't hurt me. And so that's one of the things I can give into. Because having these mental health challenges, it's a balancing process. It's learning, okay, what is actually going to interrupt my ability to function and what is not? And if it's not going to interrupt my ability to function, that's probably something I can let go of. And it's fine that I do it. It's fine that it's a tick. And then the things that are going to cause problems, those are the things that I take the time to work on and work through and talk with my therapist about and make sure that I'm staying on top of those things.
When we had author Tosca Lee as a guest on Authorpreneurs Unleashed, she talked also about her challenges with OCD. And she's a award-winning, best-selling author. And one of her series, she made her main character live with OCD. And just to kind of explain some of the things there. And it just fascinates me how, and my husband being a mental health provider, he explains 9 times out of 10, the diagnosis is simply for insurance purposes, not, you know, a clear description of what people are going through. But it's really intriguing to me how the same diagnosis can manifest itself in so many different ways. And I think, you know, as storytellers, it gives us so many opportunities to learn, to connect with our audience. Like you said, that author of the book you mentioned before didn't tell about autism the way you experience it. So you had trouble connecting with it. But also, I think storytelling is a great way to help us understand and connect with our loved ones. So I don't know what it's like to walk in the skin of somebody who has autism, but I love quite a few people who live with autism. So if I can read those stories, it's like, oh, that's why he does that. Or that's an interesting thing. You know, one of my family members is an accountant and she's very high up. She does audits and she's very good at what she does because that hyper focus really helps her. So do you find that you have the hyper focus too? Does that help you as you're cover designing? And does that help or hurt as you're revising your manuscripts? Because I'm not living with that, but I can rework a manuscript to death to the point where, you know, it not only does it not look like the original story I wanted to tell, but I spend so much time fixing it that it never gets published.
So I am, my ADHD does hyperfocus a lot, and it will hyperfocus on it, covers. It'll hyperfocus on writing. But I have, my whole family is neurodivergent. I grew up in a family of neurodivergence, and only two members of my family chose to formally diagnose. And just like you said, it was to try medication. They wanted to try medication, and that's how you try medication is you have to get formally diagnosed. So shout out to everybody else on the spectrum and other neurodivergents that chooses not to formally diagnose, because you are valid and you do need to know that. And just because you don't have a medical professional say, yes, you have autism, it does not mean you don't have autism. So sorry, sidetrack, but coming back to it, my three diagnoses or the three things I struggle with, I like to joke that it's the perfect storm, because I have learned over the years to play them off each other. One of my parents has the three as well, and they taught me how to play them against each other. And so the ADHD will hyperfocus and I can usually help direct it a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit on, okay, this is what we're hyperfocusing on. And then as I start to hyperfocus on it, I get through to the point where it's starting to peter off. And a lot of ADHDers know how that feels to be so intense on something. And then suddenly you don't want to look at it anymore. and so the way I kind of play with that is that I'm OCD about having multiple things going at once. And it does mean I drop plates a lot. I will overextend myself. I will think that I am capable of doing a whole bunch of things that I am not capable of doing. And the timeline I've set is wrong and it will not work. But I'm able to play that and have the OCD say, okay, well, you've got to have more than one thing going right now. And I'll allow myself to have more than one thing going so that when the hyperfocus starts to wane, then I can shift it to another thing. The one thing with that is the hyperfocus does really revolve around my autism special interests. I cannot turn hyperfocus on to other things. So my autism special interests are art design. I had a lot of fun in art and making art and in writing. That's another one of them. And then how humans interact. That's one of my other hyper-focuses. So you'll hear it in the autism community a lot called masking. And for me, to an extent, it is masking, but it doesn't come with all the negative connotations because it's an experiment for me. I have a lot of fun seeing, okay, well, if I do this thing that I know is something that people accept as socially acceptable, what are the reactions I get? And finding out how that plays from different groups and what is accepted. So I live in a small town in central Utah, and I live up in the mountains. And so we have a very specific culture here. And then I've been other places too. So like I've been in the Midwest and comparing what is culturally acceptable there and what's expected there and playing that game. For me, it's a special interest and it's something I can really hyper-focus on and figure out why people do what they do. And that's fun for me. It also means that in my writing, you get a lot of white room syndrome that I have to go back and fix because all I want to do is just have characters talk to each other and see how it's different.
That's so interesting. I'm quite a student of linguistics. And I think part of that is the travel to a large degree. But I grew up with my maternal grandparents in a very German influenced community. And learning how to do things in that community, what was appropriate, the word choices, a lot of the, even the English syntax would go back to the German, how their sentence structure was. So even though they were speaking English, a lot of times the words were in a different order. And then when I moved to Texas as a teenager, my parents, we had just been here like weeks, and they sent me off to church camp so I could meet kids before school started. And I'm telling you, they were speaking a foreign language. I had no idea. It's both English, but the culture and the location. And I grew up around dairy farms, and suddenly I'm in ranching community, and I'm looking at cows, but they're not called cows. And I'm looking at fencing, and it's not called the same thing. And it was just fascinating to me. And then I found, you know, in Texas, a lot of the grammatical structure is influenced by Spanish speakers. So, you know, where in Wisconsin, you would never use a double negative, in Texas, that is considered normal. And you do that and it's okay. And now we have moved to Arkansas and I'm, again, kind of feeling out. There's some unique things here. You know, they're not worried about drought and forest fires here like that. Texas. So it's interesting how that's influenced your geography, your community, what other languages are at play, gender. When I was in grad school, I did a lot of research on how gender communication works, and I find that fascinating. And because I come from an academic background, my writing's the opposite of yours. I have to force myself to add dialogue, and I have to force myself to use contractions, and I have to force myself to write in first person because that is never acceptable in academic writing. So it's really interesting how our backgrounds color, you know, how we think, how we imagine, how we world build, and then how we write about those worlds. Yeah, there's that could be a whole podcast episode on its own, I think. So how do you manage? I'm curious, because like you, I tend to commit to more than I can handle. For me, it's because of the chronic nature of my health. You know, things go wonky and I've committed to something, but now I don't have the capacity to do it. How have you figured out how to work around that? Because you do client work as well as your own creative work. Have you found any secrets that you can share? Because I can't believe you and I are the only ones struggling with that.
So I've found ways to kind of get through it. They're not great ways. So they're like not sleeping, which I'm one of those people that they're like, if you never had to eat again or you never had to sleep again, which one would you prefer to do? And I choose not eating because I would prefer to not eat. I'd prefer to take away all of the time that it takes to make food and still be able to sleep.
Okay.
So me choosing not to sleep shows you that that's a really unhealthy choice.
Yeah. I get you.
But being able to say no, which is really, really hard. But being able to look at situations and say, I don't have time for that. And then when it comes to my own projects, choosing what projects I have to work on. So like the OCD says, always have more than one thing going, because part of that moral OCD is idle hands are like the devil's playhouse. And so I always have to know that there's something I can turn to, which is its own problem. But being able to have multiple things going and then having those things prioritized in what has to happen next, and not allowing myself to jump any further ahead than the thing that has to happen next, that helps me keep my own work and the things I do for me, like my publishing and my my book designs, the YouTube channel, that lets me keep that at a point where I'm not drowning in it. And then I just have to work really hard when someone comes to me and says, hey, can you do this for me? Being able to take a step back and look at it and say, yes, I can, because I know how much time that's going to take. And I know I have that time for you. And if I don't have that time, taking a deep breath and saying no, which is really hard.
Yeah.
But as I, the older I get, the easy, well, easier, the better I am at doing it. It's not easy. It hasn't been easy ever, but it's,
I understand.
I'm better at doing it now than I was like 5 years ago.
The thing that helped me figure that out, the prioritizing and the being able to say no, because I wanted to please everybody and I wanted to be all things for all people. You know, we all go through that stage in our lives, and now I'm in my 50s and I don't care anymore. No, that's not true. But what I realized is if you say yes to everything, then by default, you're saying no to other things because you can't do it all. So I've become much more picky about what I say yes to, because I want to make sure that when certain opportunities come available, I have the bandwidth to say yes to those things. So yeah, figuring out what is a hard yes for me and what's a hard no for me helped me a lot. And I wish I had learned that sooner.
Yeah, it definitely makes life easier when I'm only saying yes to the things that excite me. There's a, a blurb writer, her name's Jessie Kniff, and she sends out, she sent out an email, and her email said it was about blurb writing, but it was also relating back to her wedding planning. And her fiance, she'd been stressing out, and her fiance grabbed her by the shoulders and said, let go of anything that does not excite you. And I loved that. I was like, that is the best advice. And it helped a lot with my blurb, because I did apply it to my blurb and it made my blurb so much better. And it cut like 10 words, I think, out of my blurb, which was huge. But I'm trying to apply that in all aspects. And so if someone comes to me and says, hey, can you do this for me? And it doesn't excite me, or the end result doesn't excite me, I'm trying to use that as my reason of saying, I'm going to pass on this one and wait for something that is actually going to build me up.
Okay, let's riff on that. So you do client work for your cover design and other graphic design, I assume. I've only heard you talk about your cover design, but you were a logo creator for a long time, right?
Yeah, so I still have a couple of clients that I work with, and it's more so because I really like these people. And so I still do stuff for them, but I don't advertise that design work anymore. Okay. And I don't do cover design for other authors. What I will do is I do a design consultation. So you can come and spend an hour with me, and I will help you with whatever design you're struggling with. So it's a professional's input and direction. So if you come and say, I don't know why my cover looks so flat, like it looks like somebody made it in Photoshop and didn't know what they were doing. And sometimes that's a very honest answer. And I applaud the authors that can say, I made it in Photoshop, I used a whole bunch of YouTube videos, and it just doesn't look right. I can sit down with you and you can show me the design, and we can talk about what's working, what's not, what needs to change, and the steps that you'll need to take to change it, and give you that one-on-one feedback. That is specifically for the authors that really are set, I'm going to do this by myself, because there are cheaper options than me. I don't charge a lot. I understand that a lot of authors are trying very hard to keep this on the low cost, but there's a website called getcovers.com. They will make you an ebook cover for $10.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And so there are options out there. Now, granted, you're not going to get exactly what you want. They're very specific. They are photo manipulated covers. They will not do illustrated covers. They have a set number of stock photos that you can choose from. They won't pull stock photos in from other places. But for $10, you can have an ebook cover, and then Draft to Digital's website will take that ebook cover for free and make an entire wraparound for you for your print book.
Like, cool. If you now, just to put that in perspective, other cover designers that I've worked with charge up to $500. Now, for that, I got the full, the ebook, the print book, the wraparound, the graphics for inside,
exactly,
you know, the book, all the things, and a little bit of marketing splash in there too. So just so listeners can put it into perspective, there is a gamut of services, but you need to know what options you have, so you can find the option that works for you, because all of us are coming from a different financial place, a different ability, you know, to do it ourselves. Some of us have that DIY gene, others don't. Some of us have the ability to see colors, others don't. So I'm always amazed when I work with somebody who is experienced at this, with either you or my other graphic design buddy. I learned so much, because there's things you guys take for granted that I don't even see until you point it out. So I know that there's a skill set, but I think there's also part of that is how your brain works. And now that I think about it, she's also ADHD and gets that hyper-focus mode going too. So I think, you know, it's just amazing to me how certain career choices, what we think is a negative, turns into our superpower, right?
Yeah, I'm definitely of the opinion that if you want to let your mental health be a benefit to you, you can make it a benefit to you. If you want it to be a stumbling block, you absolutely can make it a stumbling block. And I'm not saying that I don't have problems with it and I don't struggle with it. Something that a lot of autistics will tell you, and I am one of them, it's lonely. It is very lonely. And it's hard sometimes to realize who is your friend and who's not. But
yeah,
I've chosen to focus more on what does my autism help me with, and what does my ADHD benefit me, and how is my OCD helping me moderate and work with my autism and my ADHD, because I can pit them against each other and I can use them to pull me out of certain things. My OCD is a really great tool for pulling me out of autistic meltdowns, because if something gets shifted that I am OCD about it being exactly the way it needs to be, that will help give me direction that will pull me out and allow me to recenter and refocus and ground. Because when I'm in an autistic meltdown, the world is ending and everything is awful and everything is terrible and I don't care. And it's hard to get out of that. It's hard to pull myself out of that. But I can use the OCD to help pull me out. Whereas like the ADHD will often help keep me in it, because it's hyper-focusing on how on the meltdown and how awful everything is.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my strokes in 2010, my fifth stroke, I didn't have the physical manifestations. You know, I looked like everything was working, but something happened inside my head and I lost the ability to read emotions. I lost the ability to see color. Everything was like faded to gray. I couldn't see color. My therapist would, in rehab, they'd hand me a box of crayons and they all looked gray. It was a really bizarre time. And it was about a year, you know, before that, came back online. All noise was white noise. Like I couldn't sit in a restaurant and have a conversation. It's just something in the sensory got scrambled in my head. And fortunately, most of that is back online, but boy, that taught me a lot. You know, when I realized what had happened and when the occupational therapists were giving me, information and research and the possibility this could be life, it really brings a new perspective to things. But I learned stuff from that. You know, when you go into that dark place, I now can write a character who does that. And for some, it can be a superpower. Once I got past the fear, I kind of liked the quiet of it. You know, a lot of times color is loud, right? Mm-hmm. And even now when I'm dealing with migraines, at some migraine stages, color is just loud. And my senses get scrambled. You know, I hear a siren and I go, oh, the sirens are so bright, you know? And of course, my family knows what I'm talking about because I'm triggered by lights. So whenever we hear sirens, Catherine's ducking undercover. But it's just fascinating to me how our brains are so uniquely wired, but yet at the same time, yeah, like you said, it's all about perspective, right? You can choose to look at that as your superpower or as something detrimental to you. And I love how you put that in perspective. Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's round it out with a few other questions about being a writer. How long have you been writing and how many books have you released?
So I have been writing since 2016.
Like professionally or at all?
At all. So I didn't.
Okay.
I am not somebody who at a young age said, I'm going to be a writer when I grow up. I was someone who said,
oh, that's interesting.
I was someone who said, I'm going to be a computer scientist or a computer engineer. And I did study code for a little while and realized that that is a language that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I got past the, I got past all my introductory courses, and then we dove into Objective-C. And anybody who has coded before, if you can do Objective-C, go you, because that was where everything crashed down around my ears. And we had to reevaluate what we were going to do with our life because you can't fail classes. So we reevaluated and we shifted and I went into design. But I loved story. I always loved stories and I loved books and I loved reading and I loved escaping to new worlds and I loved romance. And in 2016, I decided to go back and reread a whole bunch of my favorite books. I hadn't been reading for a while. I'd finally got out of college because I had to start over because none of my courses were good for design. nothing transferred. So
right,
I technically did almost 2 degrees to get my 1 degree. But I started over and
I understand
and finally graduated. And I was like, I haven't read a book for fun in like 8 years. And so I started with all of my favorites. And so I went through and reread all of David Eddings' books because I love David and Leah Eddings. They're my favorite. And then I decided to pick up Harry Potter again because I hadn't read Harry Potter since I was a teenager and I loved it. It was a big deal. Like I was a Potterhead in high school. Mm-hmm. I loved it. And I got to the 6th book, and in my head, I had built up the relationship between Harry Potter and Ginny Weasley as something that actually happened in the book. And it doesn't, like, it's mentioned. They kiss, and they're together for, like, 5 paragraphs, and then it's done. And I went, what the heck? Wait a second. So I finished it. I finished the series, and then I started looking to see if I could find, like, fan art or something, because I knew that was sort of a thing in high school. And then I found fan fiction. And I was like, oh, and I started reading all this fan fiction. And something a lot of writers will tell you if that start in fan fiction is you read fan fiction, you get about 6 months into it and you go, oh my gosh, can anyone just write a story for me? Like, I want this very specific thing. And so out of spite, I wrote my very specific thing. And that was in 2016. And I started writing Harry Potter fan fiction. And I did that I still technically do that. I have friends that I write presents for. That they'll be, I know their birthday's coming up and I know what they like. And so I'll write a little short story for them. And I started in short stories. I started in stories that were less than 1,000 words. And then I moved up a little bit. And then my stories were about 4,000 to 5,000 words. And I have two fan fiction novels that are in the 80,000 word range, 90,000 word range. And that was about the point where my husband said, why are you not writing books? Why?
Good for him.
Why are you not actually doing this? I was like, oh, I can't do that. And I hemmed and hawed for a while. And then I decided to do it. And I wrote my first novel. And it's a trunk novel. It's darling. It was how I processed some grief. It's a darling book. I don't know if it will ever see the light of day. It's not marketable. And then I wrote another one. And it is also a trunk novel. Because I just didn't love how it ended up. And then I was like, okay, no, now I can do this. So I have a novella that will release on February 29th. And then the next three books in that series are drafted.
Oh, good.
So I am in the process of editing those and getting those ready so that they can go out and be out in the world. And I'm excited. This has been fun. So I have four books right now that are drafted, and one is on its way out the publication door.
Very exciting. Okay, so how can people find you? What's the best way to connect with Elaine Canyon?
So if you're an author and you want author stuff, then my YouTube channel, it's just at Elaine Canyon. That is the best way to get information from me, to connect with me. I also have a website, elainecanyon.com. That is where you can get the information for an author design consultation. It's one of your menu options up at the top. If you are interested in books, then the best place to get me is Instagram. I am on there pretty consistently. I have a lot of fun. I'm a designer, and Instagram is make cool pictures and make cool videos, and that's my wheelhouse. So I like being on Instagram. That's a great place for it. I also have a YouTube channel for my book. So it's Elaine Canyon Books or Elaine Canyon Reads. It's in the show notes. I will make sure it's in the show notes. I don't remember.
We will make sure they're all in the show notes.
I don't remember if I called it Elaine Canyon Reads or Elaine Canyon Books. I'm pretty sure it's books. But there is on Valentine's Day, a short story audiobook goes live on there. It's called Love and a Bit of Disorder. And it is with ARC listeners right now. And I'm being told that it's a lot of fun. So that story is also published in an anthology. It's called You See What Happened Was by Raconteur Press. And so it's a whole anthology of this poor person named Andrew, who is an absolute klutz and everything he does falls apart. And I wrote a 8,000 word short story where Andrew falls in love and they are ranch hands in a fantasy world.
Aw, awesome. Okay, we have all of your links. They will be in the show notes. Okay, so last thing I have to ask, what's your fave three?
Yay.
Are you a tea drinker? If so, what do you drink?
So I am an herbal tea drinker, and my favorite is licorice. It is a licorice tea. You can get it from Stash. You can get it from Yogi. They both do it. Yogi calls theirs Egyptian licorice. I like Stash's better. Stash's tea. And it's just grocery store tea. I'm not fancy.
Stash is a decent brand. Yeah. Yeah. No, I no shame there. I drink Stash too. I like that they came out with an organic line a while back. So I always try to find that. That's a little harder to find. Okay. I'm changing the order. Sorry. Because you kind of hinted on your favorite author series. Is that your all-time favorite book, or do you have another recommendation for us?
So my favorite book is by David and Leah Eddings. It is called The Redemption of Athelas. It's a standalone. It's, I think, the only fantasy standalone they wrote. He has a couple of horror books that I haven't read that he released before he started doing fantasy. But The Redemption of Athelas is a standalone fantasy, and I love it because it's technically just a fantasy book, but you can tell that Leah really wanted a lot of romance in that book because there are four romantic subplots that run through the whole thing, and it's adorable.
Oh my goodness.
And I love it, and it's found family, and it's just an absolute joy to read. I read that one at least every year.
Cool. Okay. And then the last thing, the plants. As you see my new studio, if you will, I got all kinds of plants behind me instead of books now. What's your favorite?
My favorite are stargazer lilies. And we do have some out in the yard, and they grow for about this long in my wintry climate because I live up in the mountains. We live a little bit higher than Denver to give some perspective. So people talk about the Mile High City.
Oh my goodness, that is high.
A little bit higher than the Mile High City. So they don't last for very long, but when they do last, they're gorgeous.
Okay, being a graphic designer, cover designer, what about the colors? Do you have specific stargazer lily colors?
My favorite are the pink ones, the pink, white, and purple. Those are my favorite.
I love it. I love it. Of course, anything with purple works for me, right?
Yes.
Very cool. Elaine, thank you so much for your time. I'm so glad you were open and willing to talk about some of your challenges and how you've put a positive spin on them. And hopefully we will have more conversations coming up. Actually, we are planning a collaboration. So I'm going to be on Elaine's YouTube channel and we're going to have a different conversation, not the same thing. But if you are new to Elaine Canyon, check her out on YouTube and I'll see you there. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Catherine.
Thanks for listening today. Make sure to follow and rate us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to check out entrepreneursunleashed.com/podcast for resources, show notes, and more. Come back in 2 weeks for our next episode, Catherine's quarterly review on the current industry trends and how the rapidly shifting world of AI is affecting it.